Well, I'm back again at the usual time of the year as part of your Lenten penance. It always just so happens that my spring vacation comes at exactly this time, and always during Lent, so prepare to do a little penitential suffering tonight and tomorrow. Tonight you're forced to. Tomorrow it will be your own doing. I'm delighted, as always, to be back, and it was also very good of the Minnesota winter to hold off until I got here. It was a very, very exciting landing at the airport in Minneapolis last night, an even more thrilling drive from the airport to my brother's house. Fortunately, I'd driven it before because I couldn't see out the windshield at all, so I was simply operating according to old memories and internal radar. It was very exciting. And then the drive down today was through thick fog. And again, I'd made the drive before, so I simply just, I turned on the radio and listened to some pleasant music, and the car brought me here. I'm fortunate because my family is undergoing some real troubles. My father, in fact, was just in a four-car pileup. He's doing well, but an 18-year-old girl going about 60 miles an hour in a 25-mile-an-hour zone back-ended the car behind him and plowed into my father, who plowed into the car in front of him. And it was one of those lovely chain reactions. 2 weeks ago, a 16-year-old girl plowed into my brother, did $1,000 worth of damage on his car. His children were in the car with him. They're fine. It was only 10 months ago, an 18-year-old girl ran a red light and plowed into my brother's van when his wife was with him and totaled that. And the only accident I've ever been in was when an 18-year-old girl ran a stop sign and plowed into me, spun the car around a couple of times, and as I crawled out, not quite sure what had hit me, she said, "Oh, there was a stop sign there. I wonder why I didn't see it." So I also heard on the radio on the way down that today is the International Day of the Woman. So I think I'm lucky that I made it down here in one piece without a young girl celebrating on my rental car. So even though it's one of those phony secular holidays that the modern world imposes, and of course a worldwide holiday because we're all universalists now in a false, phony, secular way, I will pay a little tribute to good women tonight. It's one of the things that I hope to talk about, because in looking at The Merchant of Venice, we have a portrait of, drawn by Shakespeare, of one of his most remarkable women, and that of course is the character of Portia. And the reason she is remarkable is that she's a good Catholic woman. And we'll look at what that means in terms of the play. It obviously has great meaning in terms of the society in which she lives, because whereas the modern woman talks a lot about going out and taking control in the world, and attempting to do so destroys automobiles, what we find is that the Catholic woman does it in a very different way. In a humble way, in a private and quiet way, but by remaining absolutely true to Catholic principles, the good Catholic woman transforms the world and changes the nature of society, just as Portia does in The Merchant of Venice. And of course, the reason is that the model for all great Catholic women is the Blessed Mother herself. That is something you know, and I won't go into it in detail tonight, but also good Catholic mothers and good Catholic wives, and good wives and mothers anywhere, at any time. I was raised by a good Protestant mother who's been a wonderful wife to my father, and she's living by Catholic principles even though she doesn't know it and can't understand it. So those values, those virtues are out in the world in many ways. And I would like to begin tonight. This is a little unusual, but it occurred to me as I was preparing this talk tonight that I have to pause and pay tribute here to a good Catholic woman by the name of Marie Cahill, C-A-H-I-L-L, who was my Shakespeare teacher back in ninth grade, the first woman to ever teach me Shakespeare. The first Shakespeare play I ever read that she introduced me to was The Merchant of Venice. She was a remarkable lady. She stood about 6 feet tall. She was taller than any of us, and I was a tall lad in those days, but she towered over me. She had white hair. She was thin. She always had that ruler in her hand. She is the portrait of what my Catholic friends tell me the old teaching nuns used to be like. Except she was a lady in the secular world, for some reason had not gone into the convent, had not become a nun, but had many of those virtues about her. I know she was very devout. I was very fond of her and didn't understand how she could be connected with that church of superstition that I'd heard so much about. It was a puzzle to me. But she ran a very ordered classroom. I had her for 2 years, 8th grade English and 9th grade English. She was the first to introduce me to great literature. At the time, I read nothing but murder mysteries. By the box, I would read hundreds at a time. So I had a habit of reading, but she slipped me first a Jules Verne novel called The Mysterious Island, sort of the later days of Captain Nemo. I was very taken with that. And since she saw I'd read almost anything, she really slipped something my way and gave me this gigantic book called David Copperfield, the first piece of great literature I ever read that began to change my life. And then she taught me The Merchant of Venice. And without knowing it, she created this monster you see standing before you who became absolutely obsessed with Shakespeare. And from that point forward, really in ninth grade, which would have been 1962, for the last 40 years, I have been devoted to Shakespeare. I've had a deep love of Shakespeare. I speak of this great Catholic lady because she gave me my vocation. And she taught me well the way a good Catholic teacher teaches. She was strict. She kept a very ordered classroom. Everyone dwelt in fear of her. She was very kind, however, and would help any student who was struggling. But most importantly, she made us learn. And some of the things I'm going to talk about tonight, I learned at her hands 40 years ago. She has gone to her reward, I think, about 10 years ago, and I would appreciate it if you would remember her in your prayers, this great Catholic teacher who lived a solitary, single life, a good woman, devoted to her God, to her church, and in ways I probably will not know for a good, well, I don't know yet. She not only gave me my vocation, but probably played a role in my conversion some years later. So her name, Marie Cal. And I pay her tribute tonight as I begin this discussion of Merchant of Venice. What we have here is one of Shakespeare's classic comedies. And I'm not going to go into a history of comedy. Actually, I'll do that this summer. I'm coming back for another marathon session over the summer. And one of the things I will be doing then is talking about Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream, again, one of his most magnificent comic works. And at that point, I'll give a little history of comedy. It's in some ways more pertinent in terms of A Midsummer Night's Dream. And also, this is called, you know, tossing out a little bait. Since I'm going to talk about the history of comedy, I'll take it from Aristophanes all the way up to Monty Python, and I will share with you the story of when I met the Monty Python troupe, how I encountered them, and how I made them laugh. It's a true story. I'm not making it, but that's for this summer. Let me just say this about the nature of comedy in terms of a basic definition. What we have in almost any comedy is a conflict, a basic conflict, because all drama is centered on conflict, a conflict between a social order, any society, and the individual who lives in that society. Because, as Aristotle says, man is a social animal, we have to live together in groups, and it's never easy, because each of us has an individual personality, an individual will, an individual set of ideas, and even if we hold ideas in common, often we have trouble getting along with each other. I'm You know, it doesn't happen here, of course, but out in the world from which I come, when you get groups of people trying to live together, there are often tensions. Now, what comedy says to us is that these tensions are very real and in a way necessary, because it is important, again, as Aristotle says, that individuals find a measure of happiness. What we are seeking in the world is happiness. And that happiness, in order to be fulfilling, has to in some way be personal. We do indeed want to find a measure of joy in the world. And very often we have a sense of what that joy should be. It's what we think we want, and obviously what we need to want is that which is the good, the true, those things that will make our happiness complete and perfect. Often we don't know that, or we're going about it in the wrong way, or we only have a partial vision. There is also the social order, and what the social order is concerned with is the good of the many. And of course, when groups of people are living together, it is necessary that they get along and that life be livable for everyone, and therefore, very often, those individual whims and desires have to be subordinated to the group. There we have a spectrum. Somewhere in the middle is that which is ultimately fulfilling, and I'll talk about it at the end of this talk, because it is possible to find that middle ground. I.e., where the individual can attain the fullness of happiness, that is, we can have indeed what we want, what we're seeking for, we can achieve a measure of joy in this world, even though the world is fallen and we are fallen, and that it is indeed often a veil of tears. This play makes that clear. This is not, from beginning to end, a play filled with joy. This is a play in which it is very clear there is a world out there that is threatening, and at any moment can step in to destroy you personally. There are forces out there that hate you and would just as soon be rid of you. And those forces threaten the happiness and the well-being of the entire social order, okay? That is very difficult. At the same time, comedy promises that it is indeed possible to create a society that is not only livable, but one in which all of that, the best possibilities can be fulfilled. There is a bit, there is a touch of the fairy tale or romance always in comedy, because comedy ends at that moment of happiness. It's simply a fact that we know if you were to look beyond that moment of pure happiness, which in the comedy most often is marriage, as the symbol of that perfect union between the individual and the social order, and as we'll see in this play, also a much greater and higher good. Nevertheless, at that moment, there is the release of joy, there is sanctification, there is the individual desire being fulfilled in most often in marriage, finding that partner that is beloved, and sanctioned by the social order. We agree to this marriage, we support this marriage, and the whole society celebrates. Everyone celebrates because not only do we have a marriage, but we now have, in the good union of a good man and a good woman, society itself renewed and regenerated, because out of that will come children. That is the future of the society itself. There will be a future. There is the sense that the society will be renewed, it will go forward, because new life will come from it. From this good couple uniting together. Marriage is the emblem of that. Always has been in any kind of comedy of romance. Those tensions are in the play. And that conflict is in the play. And heightened in this play in very real ways. Now, what we find in The Merchant of Venice, I graded a set of papers. I have not taught this play in a number of years. For fairly obvious reasons that I will discuss at length tomorrow night. I love it, obviously. I used to teach it regularly before the sea change took place out in the world in which I live. I was indeed told by my former chairman some years ago, when I got in terrible trouble for suggesting to a young female midshipman she should not read Henry Miller's Tropic of Cancer, an obscene book. He called me on the phone enraged and said he didn't think I should be allowed to teach The Merchant of Venice. People have different values. So I had not taught it in a while, simply to avoid the troubles that come when you teach it now. But I decided to, since I was coming here to talk about it, and I thought I'd just get the juices running again, and boy, they got running. But I had my students write an essay on the play, and they were filled with remarkable things, some of which I'll mention later. But my favorite was this. This came from a young female midshipman who said, in the play The Merchant of Venice, Shylock is much despised by the citizens of Padua, the city in which the action of the play takes place. They never cease to surprise and amaze you. The play is set in a city called Venice. We know this because of the title. The central character in the play is Antonio, who is the merchant of Venice. Some people have been surprised by this, but I hope in the coming discussion to make clear why Antonio is at the center of the play. He is indeed the center of the play. So the title of the play refers to the leading character, who is indeed a merchant who lives in the city of Venice. But that's only one of the worlds in the play. Shakespeare in this play constructs two very different worlds, two completely different worlds. They did quite a good job of that visually, I think, in the production that you watched last night. But just to reinforce it, the Venice that he is writing about is a Venice of his creation for the play. Most of us today, if we were go to Venice, would be overwhelmed with the beauty of it. Evelyn Waugh said that Venice is the only city in the world which is a work of art, not a city. It is a breathtakingly beautiful place. That's not how Shakespeare uses it in this play. Shakespeare uses Venice in this play to represent a world of business and money and day-to-day hard-driven details. It's a world of contracts, money men, bargains. It is also a world in which, because of that kind of business web that draws the citizens together, there is friendship. There is real friendship. But what we find is that much of that friendship is based on commercial exchange. These people know each other, associate with each other, because of the fact that they have dealt together for financial reasons. It is also a city singularly devoid of the feminine touch. The women we meet in the play come from a different world. They exist in a different world. Venice is a man's world of money, business, finance, friendship, but bargains, okay? And that's the world that we see there. This world is an affluent world. The people that we meet in Venice, Antonio, Solario, Solanio, Graciano, all are fairly well-to-do. Even Bassanio, we learn, has had money, but he's been profligate. He has had a good bit of money. He's wasted it. It's gone. He suddenly needs some at the beginning of the play. It's not there, but it's very clear. He's not been poor. He has been well-to-do, and being well-to-do, he has been wasteful. Nevertheless, we have a world of wealth that's a comfortable world, but out of the comfort of that world comes a kind of melancholy. And the very opening lines of the play make that very clear. Antonio speaks the first lines in the play that bears his name. In sooth, I know not why I am so sad. It wearies me. You say it wearies you, but how I caught it, found it, or came by it, what stuff 'tis made of, whereof it is born, I am to learn. And such a want wit sadness makes of me, that I have much ado to know myself. Shakespeare understood very well that one of the problems of living in a well-to-do society is the consciousness of something lacking. When you're desperately hungry, deeply impoverished, you're not loaded with melancholy. You're too busy trying to live, trying to eat, and those day-to-day obligations take up all your time. It is the well-to-do, it's the ones who are comfortable, that suddenly get afflicted with melancholy and begin to turn inward, looking at who they are, what kind of life they're living. And begin to, as Antonio says, I have much ado to know myself. We have a character here at the beginning who in Greek terms is finding it difficult to know himself. By the end of the play, he will know very well who he is. Now his friends, Solerio and Solanio, my favorite duo until Rosencrantz and Guildenstern in Hamlet, I joked with my students, I was making them write a paper about a minor character in the play. I said someone could write a paper distinguishing Solanio from Solerio. Nobody took me up on it. Instantly come back with an answer that is appropriate to the city of Venice. Your mind is tossing on the ocean, there where your argosies with portly sail, like seniors and rich burghers on the flood, or as it were the pageants of the sea, do overpeer the petty traffickers that curtsy to them. Okay? You're worrying about commerce. You've got ships out there. The reason you're feeling sadness is you've got business out there, and as long as those ships are at sea, there's a chance of trouble and you might lose your money. That is the depth of philosophizing at the beginning of the play, okay? Antonio has this sadness in him, and yet the only possible explanation for his friends, business worries. It gets repeated later. Graciano comes in and says, "You look not well, Signor Antonio. You have too much respect upon the world. They lose it that do buy it with much care." The very language is the language of business again. What Antonio responds with, "I hold the world but as the world, Graciano, a stage where every man must play a part, and mine a sad one." It's a little preview of that great speech Shakespeare will write a couple of plays later, "All the world's a stage and all the men and women merely players." We get a little hint of it here. But again, notice Graciano saying, uses the financial metaphor, and Antonio responds with a metaphor from the theater. So we've had the idea of maybe philosophizing, maybe of art, maybe there's something more. Maybe there's something more than just business and finance and money and getting together with friends to talk about where your ships are and how much money they're going to bring in when they come back. And that other world is Belmont. And Belmont is quite literally in this play another whole world. If Venice is a real city, Belmont is not located on any map. You can go visit Venice. You can't visit Belmont, okay? Belmont means beautiful mountain. Beautiful mountain. And it is that distant, high, faraway place. When we go to Belmont, we're going to a fairy tale world. And I use the word fairy tale very specifically because if you look at what is set up in the plot situation in Belmont, that second world of the play, we're entering a fairy tale kingdom that Shakespeare is presenting to us as real. Once upon a time, there was a beautiful princess who lived in a faraway kingdom. She waited for a handsome prince to marry, but her father, the dead king, had set up a contest. Okay? This is fairy tale stuff. And only the good young man who can pass the test gets to win the hand of the princess. This is fairy tale stuff. It's wonderful stuff, and we respond to it that way. But we've entered an entirely different world, and it is a world of beautiful ladies, which we don't find in Venice, a place where there's so much money it doesn't matter anymore, you don't have to talk about it. It's a place where music is supreme, There's music playing constantly, okay? Whether it be that insane moment in the production you saw last night. The two singers that come out right before Bassanio is going to... It's very funny. Let's just say the song could be done in a number of different ways. That's one possibility. But of course, music will dominate through Act 5. It's a world of moonlight, okay? And it's a world filled with chance and opportunity, into which many foreign and intriguing visitors come to try to win the lady. It's a wonderful setup. But if you'll notice, at the very beginning of scene 2, when we go to Belmont, the very first lines of Portia when we arrive there are, "By my troth, Nerissa, my little body is aweary of this great world." And we have there the same weariness that we hear Antonio talking about at the beginning of the first scene in Venice. This whole world at the opening of the play is weary, tired, sad. And why shouldn't it be? All the men are in Venice and all the ladies are in Belmont. There is this sense, and it's there buried in the play, that which generates life, i.e., love and marriage and family and happiness and joy, is not there at the opening of the play because the men and women are living in separate worlds. They are quite literally worlds apart. They are worlds apart. Let me go back now to ninth grade. One of the first things this good teacher had us do in ninth grade, and I remember it well, was when it came, so we have the two worlds of the play, Venice and Belmont, different worlds, embodying very, very different characteristics. One of the first things she had us do was to do a plot diagram. We had to roll out these big sheets of white paper and then draw there are three separate plots here, draw each individual plot, where the major incidents took place, where the plot lines crossed, when each one climaxed in sort of rising action, climax, falling action, for all five acts of the play. It was a wonderful activity for young people. We got to, you know, use different colored markers and down on the floor with paper. And yet what she was teaching us without my knowing at the time was that first and foremost, Shakespeare was a craftsman. This is a well-crafted piece of work. Before any artist can become great, or even an artist, the craft has to be learned first. And Shakespeare very clearly puts together this play in the same way that a good cabinet builder will build a nice cabinet. It is assembled, it is planned, it is ordered. We've got three separate plots running here simultaneously that do link together. The first and most obvious, which is connected with the title character, is the bond plot. That is, Bassanio needs money. He goes to his friend Antonio. Antonio doesn't have ready cash. He raises the money from Shylock. Shylock lends the money on the condition of the bond. The bond is forfeit. Shylock is to get a pound of Antonio's flesh. We go to court. And then the plot resolves itself, okay? The second plot is the casket plot. We have Portia. She is unmarried. She is wealthy. But in order for her to find a suitor, men must come and go through a contest in order to prove their character. They choose between the three caskets, gold, silver, and lead. Bassanio comes, chooses the lead casket, which is the correct one, and wins the lady's hand. It's the casket plot. And then finally, the ring plot that begins right after the casket plot when Portia submits to her husband. We'll talk about that later, a hugely important point, but gives him the ring as the symbol of her love and tells him never to take it off or give it away to anyone else. And of course, after the trial, he gives it to the young lawyer and then is called to account at the end of the play. Where is the ring? And we get the comic resolution that indeed the ring is there. somehow his wife has had it all along. That's the third plot. Doesn't begin, really, until the third act of the play. These interconnect. Obviously, the ring plot interconnects with the casket plot. It follows on from that. It connects with the bond plot in that he gives it away to the young lawyer. The bond plot obviously connects with the casket plot because Bassanio needs the money to go woo. It's intricately put together. It is fascinating to see, and as you know, this is an obsession of mine, a mind working out a story. No longer, this is not just a series of events. This is not just one episode after another. This is an artistically constructed set of actions that begin us at one point and lead us to another point, and does so along three different lines, okay? And I thank again dear Miss Cal for teaching me that. I want to start with the casket plot. Now let me say, all three of these plots are interconnected. They're all interconnected. Not just through intertwining, but Shakespeare develops the three plots together because they all have a common theme. And that is value. How do we know what we value? How does it have value? How do we hold it dear? Okay? In the first case, the bond plot, it has to do with a money transaction and friendship. In the second plot, it has to do with gold, silver, and lead, and marriage. In the third plot, it has to do with vows made between man and wife, and a physical object, the ring, which binds them together. Okay? So that in each case, there is something physical. 3,000 ducats, a pound of flesh, and friendship. In the casket plot, three actual caskets of gold, silver, and lead, and marriage. In the ring, a vow and promise that is made, and an actual object that has been handed from a wife to her husband, and then back again, although he didn't know it, okay? So that all three plots cohere together. There is a reason for them. There's a logic behind it. I'm beginning with the casket plot. Portia says that she's weary. Of course she's weary. She's a young woman, and young women should be married. Unless they're going to a higher calling. Fair enough. And she's complaining about the situation that she has been left in because she cannot choose the man she wants to marry. I'm right at the beginning of Act 1, Scene 2. It's her first long speech near the end of it where she says, "But this reasoning is not in the fashion to choose me a husband, oh me, the word choose. I may neither choose who I would nor refuse who I dislike. So is the will of a living daughter curbed by the will of a dead father." And again, we have an abstract concept, the woman's will, and something very real. Her dead father put it down on paper, okay? There is a will of that dead father, and she, okay, "Is it not hard, Nerissa, that I cannot choose one nor refuse none?" Again, one reason this play is anathema to a modern audience is that obviously we have here a young woman who's been denied freedom of choice. She's clearly been denied it because she has a father who loved her. She had a father who loved her enough in order to still care about her, instruct her, guide her, and ensure her happiness from beyond the grave. There are a couple of words for this. The father overseeing the daughter and the entire estate he's left behind. It's called patriarchy. It's a dirty word now. I'll come back to that in a moment because there are other fathers in this play. It is interesting that the most prominent, loving and successful father is dead. But he has handed down something through his will to ensure his daughter's happiness. Okay? He may not be there in the flesh, but he is there in his love. And the love takes the form of a very real, specific, and clearly designed task before any young man who wants to wed his daughter. He's not making it easy for her or them. Is it not hard, Nerissa, that I cannot choose one nor refuse none? And Nerissa comes right back. Your father was ever virtuous, and holy men at their death have good inspirations. It's a wonderful line. And it tells us all we need to know about Portia's father. Not just a good man, a holy man, Nerissa calls him, okay? And he's proving it again by what he's done for his daughter. Therefore, the lottery that he hath devised in these three chests of gold, silver, and lead, whereof who chooses his meaning chooses you. Notice that. Not who chooses which casket, but who chooses his meaning. It's a wonderful, wonderful notion. What that suitor is choosing is what he himself believes in. And then he will be rewarded with something inside the casket. Whereof who chooses his meaning chooses you will no doubt never be chosen by any rightly but one who shall rightly love. And it's been set up so that when she does get a husband, it's going to be the right husband, the one who will love her in the proper way. It's beautifully done. Now, let's go to the caskets, as they say. Let's go to the caskets. Because what we have in the three caskets defines the entire play. We get the entire play in the meaning inscribed on each of the three caskets, because in each one there is a temptation, or at least a clear decision to be made. And what we're getting in the choice tells us about the one choosing, okay? So I'm getting a little ahead of myself, but let's go to, I'm jumping ahead to Act 2. It is indeed the Prince of Morocco who comes first. He thinks very highly of himself, as he makes clear from the very beginning. And he is also very well aware of being a foreigner. His first lines, mislike me not for my complexion, the shadowed livery of the burnished sun, okay, to whom I am neighbor and near bred, bring me the fairest creature northward born, where Phoebus' fire scarce thaws the icicles, and let us make incision for your love to prove whose blood is reddest, his or mine. It's wonderful. Don't look at my outside, look at my inside, which is a joke, because what's he going to choose? The gold, because of what's on the outside. It's a wonderful little joke. By my love, I swear, the best regarded virgins of our clime have loved it too. I would not change this hue except to steal your thoughts, my gentle queen. Very full of himself. Very full of himself. She has a wonderful line in response to him where she says, I told you yourself, renowned prince, that you then stood as fair as any comer I have looked on yet for my affection. Of course, she and Nerissa just ran down the list, and she finds them all just contemptible. You know, we've got the one who drinks too much, the one who loves his horse more than anything else in the world. I mean, just this, the suitors who have come have not been adequate, but we know as a result they've all chosen wrongly. So she's very polite to this man and says, quite simply, you stand as fair as any comer I've looked on yet. We might almost call the response Jesuitical in a way, because she hasn't thought very highly of the others. And this is an astonishing thing. This is an astonishing thing. It makes perfectly clear that Portia has some character. That is, her father may have devised the test, but she still wants a man that she can love. She is a little perturbed at first that she can't choose that man, that she has to be guided by her father's will, but she wants a good man. And the ones who have shown up have been a pretty shabby lot. And now this man shows up, and as she will say when he leaves, there's a very real problem with him. which is simply this. He's not of her race. He leaves. End of Act 2, Scene 7. She says, a gentle riddance. Draw the curtains. Go. Let all of his complexion choose me so. Well, you can imagine. I got at least three or four papers writing about the Prince of Morocco, and Portia is racist. She's just racist. She's judging the man by his outside. You know, she does not want to marry this black man. I'll tell you, it's simply astonishing. You can no longer say to them something as simple as like tends to like. That is, there is the desire on the part of Portia to marry someone who is similar to her. And not just in race, but in terms of background, shared experience. And what Shakespeare makes very clear, he presents the Prince of Morocco as a character with failings, but those failings have to do with his pride. But nevertheless, he's from out there, and she's not interested. Occasionally I'll get to them, I'll say, you know, would you expect to see a robin mating with a blue jay? They say, well, heavens no. I say, they're all birds. if you had something against robins? These responses are so set now, you need to be prepared for it out there because it's very frightening. We don't have to deal with the scenes of the play. Portia's a racist. Dismiss her. Let's go back and read our bad Maya Angelou poetry. It's just astonishing stuff. Obviously, in this play, there are worse traps. We'll come to that later. The problem with the Prince of Morocco, and let's go to the scene where he chooses, okay? Because it's through there that we first get the glimpse of what it is that the gold casket is all about. He runs through the others quickly and then simply says, okay, I'm in Act 2, Scene 7, Line 20. He dismisses the lead casket. A golden mine stoops not to shows of dross. I'll then nor give nor hazard aught for lead. What says the silver with her virgin hue, who chooseth me shall get as much as he deserves. As much as he deserves. Pause there. He thinks through it. He dismisses the silver. We finally get to the gold. Line 35. Let's see once more this saying, graved in gold, who chooseth me shall gain what many men desire. Why? That's the lady. All the world desires her. From the four corners of the earth they come to kiss this shrine, this mortal-breathing saint. Doesn't know what the word means. Doesn't understand it, okay? And his logic, his argument, finally simply comes down to this. He indeed should have what many men desire. And he chooses the gold. What is inside the gold casket is the death's head. We've got a little comic treatment of a very real fact. All desire that is simply desire and rooted in earthly ends, i.e. gold, or the lady as wife, merely as wife, as prize, will end in death. Because all earthly desire can only go to the grave. Now, it doesn't matter if it's simply a matter of human desire. The male animal looking upon the female and feeling physical desire, or the desire for gold, or the desire for fame, i.e. the Prince of Morocco. Any of this is basically rooted in the earth. And being rooted in the earth is going to come to dust. Because it comes out of the dust. Whether it be physical desire, or gold, or fame, None of it can last. He finds the death's head, and within the empty eye, okay, there is a written scroll. I'll read the writing. All that glisters is not gold. Often have you heard that told. Many a man his life hath sold, but my outside gold. Gilded tombs, worms enfold. Had you been as wise as bold, young in limbs, judgment old, your answer had not been enscrolled. Fare you well, your suit is cold. It's a wonderful dismissal. But it's an absolutely real point. If you are attached to the earth, if what you are seeking is the earthly end, then your end is death. All desire leads to death. All desire, earthly desire, leads to death. If that is the end in and of itself. And there it is. I will come back to this, but please notice all of that talk that we've already heard in Act 1 and will continue to hear about those ducats, 3,000 ducats, or the ducats that are stolen when Jessica flees with Lorenzo. Those ducats are made of gold. And hence they are connected with the gold casket. And the obsession of Shylock about those ducats is an obsession for an earthly end. That somehow, the play already tells us before we get to Act 4, is going to lead to merely an earthly end. That is nothingness. He's going to end up with nothing. He's going to end up with nothing, okay? That's the gold casket, okay? The silver casket, Prince of Aragon. That's very funny. Nicely done in the version you saw last night. Again, all the talk in the play about silvered over. It's great. He was perfectly silver. He was older than the hills themselves. Chooses the silver. And what he finds inside, and again, a nice touch in the production. In the play, it's the portrait of a blinking idiot. What he pulls out is a mirror and doesn't realize he's looking at himself. There is a measure of wisdom in being able to look at yourself in a mirror and see the fool that is there. He does not even recognize himself as a fool. It was a nice touch. But again, whether it is the mirror or, as suggested in the play, the portrait of a blinking idiot, we are being shown our own foolishness, which is why, because the inscription on the silver casket, "Who chooseth me shall get as much as he deserves," as much as he deserves. And well said too, "For who shall go about to cousin fortune be honorable without the stamp of merit?" Okay? He decides, and it's wonderful, "Well, but to my choice, who chooseth me shall get as much as he deserves. I will assume desert." He says, "I will assume I am worthy. I will assume that this lady belongs to me because I deserve her." Well, what do we deserve? If we are so proud and foolish to assume that we should get what we deserve, we're fools. We're fools, okay? What is here? "The fire seven times tried this. Seven times tried that judgment is that did never choose amiss. Some there be that shadows kiss. Such have but a shadow's bliss. There be fools alive with silvered ore, and so was this. Take what wife you will to bed. I will ever be your head. So be gone. You are sped." Of course, part of the contest is he may not take a wife to bed. Okay? You go through the contest, you never get to marry. Reason being, again, Portia's father is wise enough. Anybody who chooses the gold or the silver doesn't deserve to be married. It's best they live a solitary life. We don't want them out there producing progeny in the society, okay? So they're enforced, okay? They're enforced then to the celibate life. Now, If we look at that inscription, "Who chooseth me shall get as much as he deserves," we suddenly go back to the Greeks and get a classic definition for what? Justice. The idea that true justice is rendering to each man exactly what he deserves. That is, if I expect justice out in the world, then what the world will give to me is what I have properly earned. So if I go into a court of law and I get justice, I get true justice, then a wise judge will have determined the case, heard the evidence, truth will have prevailed, and the ultimate verdict will be an accurate reflection of the way things should be resolved. And I will get justice. What is justice? Giving each man what he deserves. For someone to come to win a bride, and again, to be lured by, one, the outside, the silver, and two, by the promise of, you'll get what you deserve, again suggests pride. Because according to the good father, the holy man, Nerissa calls him, Portia's father, he knows that what we deserve is judgment and death. No man should seek after what he deserves. We would be fools, fools, to stand at the bench of justice, earthly justice, heavenly justice, and say, give me as a man just what I deserve. We're all in prison for life or in hell for eternity. Okay? Because on our own, of our own doing, going, if you will, to win the bride, if we assume we're bringing the merit and I get what I deserve, I'm a fool. Now notice again, what have we got here? We have a clear reflection on the bond plot. When Shylock goes into that courtroom demanding justice, 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 what is he demanding? He is demanding what he thinks he deserves. Classic definition. So that again, as the first casket, the golden casket, set up the golden ducats, the second casket, the silver casket, is setting up the idea of justice, demanding justice. And already before we even get near Act 4, before the plot has even turned and we discover Antonio's ships are lost at sea, before Shylock begins pursuing his bond against Antonio, we should realize it's not going to work. Because this man who has been obsessed with gold is going to find dust and death. And this man who is insisting only on justice may indeed get what he deserves and end up a broken fool. It's in the inscriptions on the caskets, which takes us to the third. Bassanio comes. He looks at the third casket, which is the leaden casket, and indeed the inscription is, "Who chooseth me must give and hazard all he hath." There is no outward show. There is nothing in and of the casket to attract the eye. There is nothing to attract the pocketbook. Hey, I choose, you choose gold, you've still got the casket, you got a little money. You choose the silver, hey, I get hard up, I can trade this in, I can pawn this. I can pawn this and get me a good jug of Chianti, okay? Very vintage Chianti. I can make something of this. I've got the lead casket, I got nothing. I got nothing. It, in and of itself, it's nothing. Okay? And it is no longer a matter of getting. I've come here to win the lady. I win the lady, I win a wife. I get a beautiful woman. I get her fortune. I get the estate. Look what I get. Nope. The lead casket says, who chooseth me must give. This is pure Catholic thought. You don't think about getting. You think about giving. First and foremost. Inherent in the inscription on the golden casket is a kind of high charity. That is real love. Forget about the lady. Forget about the contest. You come here. You choose me. You give. You give. But not just giving. Must give and hazard. Hazard. You make this choice. You don't know what you're going to get. You indeed are putting everything in jeopardy. You come here. You may never be married. You may have nothing in return. You may leave an absolute fool. You may have offered up everything and gotten nothing in return. Well, why choose the lead casket then? Why hazard such a thing? Because I believe that's the one. Because I believe there's something in there that the others don't hold. Because something, I can't give you a completely logical reason, okay? Logic will take me so far. I don't want the gold. I don't want the silver sheen outside. There's something plain and basic here. I've got what? I've got a measure. I believe that's the one. Hazarding, it becomes an act of faith that seems to go against logic or all outward signs. Must give and hazard all he hath. Go and sell everything you have, give it to the poor, and follow me, okay? You give it all up. You want to choose the lady? You want to choose this route? You want to take this chance? Then you give it all up. You give it all up. Not just the money you gave up to come here, not just your future as a married man, you give up everything. Who chooseth me must give and hazard all he hath. The choosing of the lead casket becomes clearly an act of faith, an act of humility, an act of charity. Okay, we've got faith, hope, and charity in choosing that one casket. Now, this is a comedy. There is a lovely touch here. There's a lovely touch. Portia has seen how many suitors come and go. Quite a few. And things are getting tough, especially since we saw the last two. I mean, this is what she's facing, please. And now the young man has come that she really wants to marry. Please notice, this gets lost. This gets lost. It's almost always lost in production. She says, let's have a little music before you decide. I'm in Act 3, Scene 2. Okay? So, he may win. What is music then? Music is even as the flourish when true subjects bow to a new crowned monarch. Such it is as are those dulcet sounds in break of day that creep into the dreaming bridegroom's ear and summon him to marriage. Let's have music. Let's have music like on the morning of a wedding day. Okay? In come the singers. Notice what they sing. Tell me, where is fancy bred? Okay, fancy. Love based on the imagination or the senses. Okay? Tell me, where is fancy bred? Or in the heart or in the head? How begot? How nourished? Reply, reply. The question posed, where does love come from? Where does love come from? Sensual love, earthly love? It is engendered in the eye. Earthly love, sensual love comes from the eye. With gazing fed, ooh, looks great, ooh, I'm excited. The longer I look, it's like eating, like that, ooh. And the senses get more excited. And fancy dies in the cradle where it lies. Where? In the eye. If you are doing what? If you are loving or judging by the eye, you're going to end up with what? Nothing. Because it begins there, it ends there. Let us all ring fancy's knell. I'll begin it, ding-dong bell, ding-dong bell. any fancy, any love that is earthly love, that is sensual love, that is born in the eye, that is to say that judges by outward appearances or what is seen is going to live and die right there. What is the song doing? Giving him a little hint if he's smart. She's not cheating precisely, but she's having a little music before. I know. Let's have a little song before you choose. You know, music is wonderful. It's sort of what summons the bridegroom on the morning of his wedding. Let's listen to the music, fella. Love it. And in fact, notice the first rhyme. Bread, head, nourished, rhymes with lead. So if you're following the poetry, there's even a little hint in the rhyme scheme. I love it. Is she violating her father's orders? Well, not really. Is she being a smart cracker of a lady? She sure is. And she's in there working a bit to direct things to an end she wants. It's a touch of willfulness. But Bassanio, if he's a dumb cluck, is still going to miss it. Okay. It's still entirely possible for him to go wrong, except notice he catches it immediately. The song ends in his next lines, so may the outward shows be least themselves. The world is still deceived with ornament. Yeah, can't judge by the outside. Can't judge by... And he goes on, and it's a magnificent speech in which he expands on that idea. It is sheer foolishness to judge by externals. So that the song prompts a response, his response is thoughtful and extended, and at the end of it, okay, he dismisses the gold, he dismisses the silver, and says, but thou meager lead, which rather threatenest than dost promise aught, thy paleness moves me more than eloquence. It's just beautiful. And here choose I, joy be the consequence. And it's one of those glorious moments where, you know, the whole audience is cheering and applauding. Yes, because, you know, we want the young lovers to get together. They're nice young folks. We want it to work. But please notice there's something higher going on. And that is her father's scheme has worked to his daughter's good. There's no doubt about it. But it's because Bassanio is a man who can indeed grasp the world around him, hear what's told him, but at the same time, he's the one who has had to choose. And he chooses to give and hazard all he hath.
This concludes the first CD. Please insert CD 2.